Some of the main points from yesterday is understanding what shamatha was. And so you're looking at what you have here is a path of attentional development that accumulates in sustained voluntary attention for hours on end. To develop that, there are many objects that you can use. Shamatha was around before the time of the Buddha, and people regularly used stones, sticks. I read somewhere of dog poo, but basically you could use anything to develop shamatha, Of course, within the Dharma, you make shamatha a Buddhist practice by imbuing, by your motivation, and then imbuing everything you're doing with the bodhicitta motivation. That mind that wants to become enlightened simply to benefit all sentient beings. Once you imbue your practice with that, then it's a Dharma practice, clearly, a Mahayana practice. Within the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, there are differences in objects that they emphasize, you know, basically due to their understanding of the nature. Some of the schools differ in Buddha nature, what they think Buddha nature is. And because of that, they have preferences for different types of objects. But all four schools, are these three practices that Lama Alan Wallace is teaching, deeply embedded in all four schools. So we can have confidence in that. We can have strong confidence in that. And indeed, I have, when I was checking this all out, long time ago, I wasn't sure, because the emphasis in the Galupa is always really on visualization. And then I was able to read some of the books His Holiness wrote, especially Simon Dzogchen, and his many sayings about this being very valid. So I'm actually very happy with that. And I think you should be quite happy. All schools, breath, mind and its contents, and awareness. We then looked at the first two stages of attentional development by Kamala Shila. And if you remember those first two stages, stage one was your ability to focus within, say, a 24-minute session for a few seconds, on the actual object of your choice. If you do that consistently, then you can say, I have achieved stage one. The power behind that, definitely, the ability to learn the instructions, that's it. And stage two, you're developing this on further. So now you're looking that regularly within a 24-minute session, say, there are a couple of times now where you can focus for a whole minute on that topic, on that voluntary object. Now, when we say focus, of course, you'll still have agitation, you'll still have dullness, sometimes a very high degree. And remember, we talked about the different levels of coarseness, of agitation, coarse, medium, and subtle. Same for dullness, coarse, medium, and subtle. So this is always going on. And progress through the path is really rooting out subtler and subtler forms of agitation and dullness. That's really what it's about. And achieving stage two. If you achieve stage two, it seems to be quite clear, both in practice and in the text, that this is when you start to see the difference in your ordinary practice, in your everyday practice, your ability to really focus well without, you know, without really losing that object, but even for a minute, regularly for a minute, that brings huge dividends. And now the power that you're adding to the power of actually learning the instructions, the power you've got now is really always reflecting on the topic, always reflecting on the practice. Here's your power. Don't expect it to come from excellent teachings. Don't expect it to come, well, it doesn't come from an external source. It comes from an internal source. You develop these powers yourself. External sources, teachers, texts, this is very helpful, very, very helpful. But no one gives you this power. You develop it. So we did that. Then we looked at the different postures, if you remember. And the Buddha taught four different postures. But for shamatha, two are supreme. Sitting, and that means sitting in whatever posture keeps your back reasonably straight, keeps the head in the right position, keeps your arms so your body's kind of well ventilated. You can have your hands on your knees or your hands in your lap, the normal meditation posture. And the traditional one of the left hand supporting the right, thumbs together and pulled in towards the abdomen. Just relaxed like this. Very good. Very good. And the supine position. And I encourage you to learn this well. Certainly if you have a yoga teacher course or you're used to yoga, this will not be a problem. But learn how to do it. Be discriminating with what's on YouTube. Some of it's a bit odd, but you know, you can learn. You can learn. And the ideal thing is having that being quite straight. It's to do with energy channels, keeping quite straight. So when you're actually in that position, being able to mentally draw a line from between your ankles to your navel, then up to your chin, that's helpful. You know, some yoga teachers said, don't use pillows, but according to Lama Allen and a few others, no problem. The problem is comfort. So pillow underneath your head, pillow underneath your head. And whether you always are in one position and that's your favorite position, learn the other. There will be times when you really need to know these two very well. Don't limit yourself. Don't make my mistake early on. You don't need to do that. Then we looked at the breath. One of the primary objects, this is what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught developing shamatha on the breath. Many of the great teachers used the breath. And the way they did it, it gets quite involved, especially Asanga's method gets very, very involved. And it's all to do with the breath, all to do with counting. It's kind of quite intense. But the breath was seen as, you know, a very supreme object. And we looked at how the breath affects the whole body. We looked at the field approach. How do you use the breath for a field approach? Is there going to be time in my life when this field, is this just a stepping stone or is it useful? It's extremely useful. The field approach, where you're watching how your whole body responds to each in-breath and out-breath. It's deeply relaxing, deeply healing, deeply healing. And we looked at the breath in relation to the abdomen because we were looking at stability. We were looking at stability. And there's very little that brings about a stable mind and a still body better than placing your awareness on the rise and fall of the abdomen with the breath. Is there times outside of shamatha when this meditation is useful? Yes, yes. Of all the quick fire meditations, I find this very, very useful. You know, when things are getting a bit difficult, I find a quiet spot, spend a few minutes watching the abdomen, you know, not watching, but just focusing on the rise and the fall. I don't know. There's only about three meditations I know that calms me very quickly. And this is one of them. So don't see it just as a stepping stone. In and of itself, highly effective. Highly effective. And understanding the need for relaxation, for stability, we understood the need for vividness. Vividness. And vividness tends to marry closely if you can rise and elevate your object of attention. The lower your object is, the quieter the mind, but easy to slip into dullness. And so rising your attention, for instance, to the breath at the entrance to the nostrils, the sensation of the breath there, or the upper lip. It's good. I mean, it just wakes you up very, very good. And of course, for many people developing shamatha on the breath, that's where they stay. They incorporate all their knowledge and their wisdom and their understanding, but that's where they stay. Is this good for anything else? Oh, yes. Prior to anything you're doing, whether it's secular or dharmic, spending a few minutes before you engage, watching, being one with the sensation of the breath will sharpen the mind. Will sharpen the mind. And so these three, yes, they're incremental up to this, but in and of themselves, very valuable, very valuable. Then, reminding ourselves that, you know, we want to make shamatha a bodhicitta practice, understanding that shamatha sits squarely in the great scope of the lamrim. On one side of shamatha, the only thing in the great scope, bodhicitta. On the other side of shamatha, sitting right next to it, is emptiness. These three are what make up the great scope. And so now we realize, okay, apart from being a nice person, I really need to imbue this with the right motivation. And so developing, and not so much developing, most people are very kind. So understanding the difference between ordinary compassion and great compassion would be a good step forward to coming towards a bodhicitta motivation. There is a difference. But what is interesting is if you have ordinary compassion, you can develop bodhicitta, no problem. You can do it. Okay. So then we did, there's lots of bodhicitta meditations. The ones based on the four immeasurables, I personally think are excellent, and they're extremely well laid out in Alan Wallace's book, so very easy to practice. And we did that. Quick review. Have I missed anything out that you thought was useful that I should talk about? It's easy to forget these things, so I like to give a quick review. Okay, so what we do now is I want you to, just in your imagination now, don't have to meditate at the moment, I want you to imagine that you've successfully completed these 7 days with me, right? You've done it, you've hung on in there, and you're completed. Okay. You get interested. You got interested and you started to read around the topic really well, really well. You're beginning to notice some difficulties in the practice, but you know, you're going ahead with it. And so you've maybe decided to do a bit more online learning or go to some retreats with some good shamatha teachers, get some advice on that. If you're following what I'm saying, then you can do no better, in my opinion, than Glenn Svensson, who's Alan Wallace's main teacher. So Lama Alan Wallace and Glenn Svensson, I have been so impressed over the years. Amazing. The depth they go to, the context, hard to go wrong with these people. So let's say you've decided to do that. So you've done that. You've now decided that I'm going to start doing this daily. Okay, I'm not going to go on a quick retreat, you know, but I'm going to start to do this daily. And you decided to either do it daily as a separate practice, or as part of your own daily practice, your own daily commitments, your own daily Dharma practice. I want you to think that now. This is where you are now, right? Just imbue it. Here's what I've done. Here's the stage I'm in. Okay, that's what I'm going to do. From now on, I'm not doing 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there. I'm starting from ground zero. I am now going to do a 24-minute session. Everything else seems a bit complicated, so I'm going to start. My object will be the breath. Okay? So that's what I want you to go on in your mind now. Now, you look around the room. Have you got enough there to keep you comfortable? Have you decided whether you're going to sit or lie down? Okay. So what you're going to do now, I'm going to lead you in this, but I want you to imagine that because you've learnt the instructions, and because you've reflected often on the practice, that the voice you hear is your own consciousness, is your own mind reminding you what to do. So I'm not going to give too many instructions. This is your own mind giving you these instructions. Try to get that now. So please check your posture. When you're checking your posture, you're reminding yourself if you're lying down that this is this is not a rest here, you know. Mentally challenge yourself. This is a meditation posture. You're sitting, you gently raise your sternum. So you're ticking off all these points. Where do I start? Oh, yes. Allowing my consciousness to sink down through the body. And as my consciousness sinks down through the body, I'm going to relax deeply on each out-breath. I'm now aware of where my body touches the earth and where one part of my body touches the other. I'll allow my awareness on the in-breath just to emerge and flow to every part of my body. Feeling my belly, moving my diaphragm, feeling my chest. So joyful. Okay, now from my feet to my crown, I have to notice sensations. And as I notice these sensations, I will relax and release them on the out-breath. And I will avoid all movement. I'm going to take a deliberate initial breath in a minute through my nostrils, allowing my belly, the movement of my diaphragm, my chest to fill, and then just let it go. Don't breathe out heavily. I'm just going to let it go, and I'm just going to be fully aware of the sensations that this brings. And now I can just breathe as normal. No need to impose any rhythm or influence or preference. Let it do what it wants to do. I'm going to sharpen my awareness by observing the complete and entire in and out breath. The beginning, the middle, and the end. That's my job. And on the periphery, I'm going to just gently notice if my breathing is long or short, deep or shallow, slow or fast. I won't get involved. Simply note. I won't be put off by any thoughts or ideas. They happen anyway. I just won't focus on them. And I will just relax more deeply and release them on the out-breath. Pay no attention to it. Simply release. I must remember that when I do release on the out-breath, just to let the in-breath flow in effortlessly, like an incoming tide, so gentle. How long do I stay here? Well, how relaxed am I? It's not perfect. My body's certainly not asleep, but it's not bad. This is reasonably relaxed. I'm going to maintain that and move on to the next stage. Becoming fully aware of the rise and fall of my abdomen with each breath. I keep getting mental images, but don't worry. Put them to the periphery. Just think of the sensations, the rise and fall. I'm getting a bit sleepy here. I better do something. Oh, yes. I'll begin to count. Rise and fall, one. Rise and fall, two. 1 to 10. That'll keep me from getting too dumb. As the dullness lifts, you can begin now to keep your awareness, sharpen your awareness, so your beginning of the beginning, the middle, the end of each sensation of movement. And even when there's a pause in the movement, the sensation of movement, you're aware of it. What is it again that never changes? When I get too dull, I arouse my attention on the in-breath and refocus. If I become distracted or restless, I relax on the out-breath and refocus. Arouse and relax. That's my job. How long do I stay here? Well, how stable are you? How still and stable is your body and mind? Doesn't have to be perfect, but is it reasonable? There's a strong temptation for me to stay here. This is lovely. But I'm stable enough now. So I'm going to elevate my focus of attention to a subtler object. I'm becoming aware now of the sensation of the breath at the nostrils and the upper lip. That is my focus. Breathing normally, naturally, impose no rhythm. And dealing with difficulties doesn't change. So again, encountering all difficulties, any agitation, by relaxing, releasing on the out-breath, then refocusing. Dullness creeps in, arousing my attention on the in-breath and refocus. That's all I have to do. Let's see how I do for 10 minutes, simply 10 minutes. And I will count the breaths to help me, to anchor me here. Each in and out breath, mentally and quickly label 1. And you're quiet for the rest of the breath. And I will count from 1 to 10, then back to 1. See if that helps anchor me where I want to be, where I've chosen to be. the sensation of the breath at the nostrils. Thank you. So any comment on that practice? Anything that you thought went well or was a bit tricky? Good. Oh, yeah.
I've got a very bad microphone, Venerable Mary. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, it's a bit muffled, but I can hear you.
Okay, better?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so I just wanted to say that the fact that, you know, on stage one, if you can hold it for a few seconds, that is so encouraging.
Yeah.
Really. In my mind, I had that mind that was going, oh, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't hold it, I can't hold it. And so it's just very encouraging, and I just thank you.
It is. This is not me. This is the teachings. These are centuries old teachings. This is not me. It's just that although it is deeply rooted, shamatha is deeply rooted within the Tibetan teachings more than anywhere else. I've been, you know, it's been for me a long time, 40 years or so, coming up to, is it about that? And in all that time, it was very hard to get teachings on shamatha. It wasn't, for quite a few reasons, it wasn't that available. It's really only in the last maybe 10, 11 years that shamatha has started to come front and center. Because, I think it's because His Holiness started mentioning it, that how beneficial it would be for all practitioners of Dharma. And from then, teachers who seem to be reluctant to teach are teaching it. And so we were starting to get directed towards that. But then finding out about the different types of shamatha, how to develop, even though the stages were there, if you read many, there are many books on shamatha, and if you start reading around, you'll find, I found quite complicated. I'm not stupid, but I found a lot of them very complicated and very busy. When you're developing shamatha, especially for many people on a visualized object, if you don't have that skill, it's extremely busy and tiring on the mind. I found that. And then a few teachers started to talk about, you can do this on the breath, you know. Now, Tibetan teachers would say things like, yes, you can do it on the breath, but better that you visualize. That was always like that. That was your response. And then teachers started to really look more deeply. And I think a lot of it was to do with people becoming more interested in Dzogchen meditation. And people started to read quite widely. And then Lama Alan knew how important this was. And he'd been 12 years a Gelugpa monk. And he started, and his main teacher for a long time was His Holiness the Dalai Lama. But he started to look into Kagyu practices, Nyingma practices, and it's very clear, you know, for those who have lots of intrusive thoughts, for those who are kind of restless by nature, find it difficult to visualize, then perfect is the breath. Perfect is mind in its contents, and superb is awareness. And so from that, he merged this with his teachings, and he started to teach this more and more. And he infused it so deeply with bodhicitta that people flocked to it. And I've never met people, well, it's rare to meet someone who's attended his teachings that haven't come away from being benefited. And so now it's kind of more widely. And so from Kamala Shila, not myself, but Lama Alan Wallace, but because of his promotion of it, it's very clear. And how much better it is to say to yourself, I'm achieving shamatha. How much better? This is what Lama Alan says. How better to say to yourself, I am achieving shamatha, as opposed to, I can't do this. Because what you're seeing is the end result, because that's how it's promoted. But if you could see the end result, your goal is being able to focus for a couple of seconds in a 24-minute session and be able to do that regularly. I've achieved stage one. You have no idea the smile on my face from here to here. When I was, you don't talk about this with everything, but if you've got a close friend, you know, who's in the Dharma, you can say, I've achieved save one, but you don't talk. But you know what I mean? It's just so liberating. And the whole part is about achieving it. It's not about whether you're good or bad. It's about whether you're achieving it. So thank you for saying that, because it was one of the most exciting things. Well, that plus I could do it lying down. Oh, that was me so completely, really. Yeah. With my joints, that was perfect. Thanks. Anyone else find the... yes, Elizabeth.
Hello, everybody. Nice to see everybody. I just wanted to say I've tried lying down. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Thank you. Yes.
And I was aware. I wasn't falling asleep like yesterday afternoon where I had the snooze.
But you look divine. You look divine. You're not the first person to fall asleep in my sessions, so I take it as a compliment. You're relaxed. That's great.
But this morning, it was like the body was so relaxed. Yesterday, it was sitting and it was very relaxed, although the mind was very alert.
Sure.
But here, it was like the body was so relaxed and like sink a bit, and that the mind alert was above it.
Yes. Good. Excellent. And it's not for nothing that Lama Alan emphasizes this, because he calls it the recovery position. He says, go into the recovery position. That's what he says. So anything going wrong, difficult, and you're thinking, I'm just not getting this, change it, go into the supine and see how you're doing in that. Because the supine, within really, you know, a couple of minutes, you're as relaxed as you can be. Really. I mean,
but I was wondering if it was advisable to feel like you're kind almost out of your body.
Well, you get a lot of sensations. When doing shamatha, you're mostly, we live our life skimming, like water skiing. If the water was our consciousness, we spend most of our life skimming, water skiing, very, very surface. Very, very surface. And then shamatha is a bit like putting a snorkel on, you know, and just going a bit deeper and going, ooh, you know.
Yeah. I've been scuba diving.
Yeah. Whoa. So because you're doing this, you're moving a lot of the energy winds around. And the energy winds can then, this doesn't happen usually immediately. I mean, you normally get a wee thing occasionally and you just ignore it. But there can be things once you start scuba diving, the mind, because of the movement of the winds, then there's things come up. You can get visions of the Buddha. You can get horrible thoughts, really nasty, vicious thoughts, sexy thoughts, things that you haven't thought about for years. It could be colors. The movement of the wind, none of this is to be paid any attention to, none of it. It's just coming from your consciousness. And it's not pertinent to anything. Not to anything. But what's our habit? Our habit is when nasty things come up, we tighten and force it away. This is not shamatha. Shamatha is we focus. If you don't give these things any energy, they die, they disappear. They have no inherent existence of their own, unless you give it some. So the problem is not so much with nasty ones, it's when do your lovely ones come, you know. I get people saying, I had a lovely vision of the Buddha, Mary. I said, oh, that's nice. Oh, Mary, he just walked into the room and he was sitting there as clear as, I said, that's absolutely fantastic. How did your meditation go? What do you mean? I said, well, you were meant to be focusing on the breath. What happened? But Mary, I got this... Buddha came in and, oh, and he blessed him. That's really nice. That's really nice. How long did you stay on the breath? And I have to do this a few times before people get the idea that what they'd happened is something had come up in their minds. They got so attracted to it, attachment and craving. I like it, I want it, and I want more of it. That's our habit.
But it's happened, I'm sure, to other people, so really.
I don't get this, no, but still, yeah, other people, yeah.
So,
and they get so carried away, Elizabeth, so carried away.
So, some randomly, I mean, during the meditation session, I think that, as you say, it's somebody from another thought, like, or something, or a random thought, or many, many years ago, just arise.
That's right. Because you've
come out of it.
You've stilled the mind.
How did that happen? Where did that come from?
It's there. It's already in your mind, but what's happening is you're stilling the mind, and then occasionally you get these arising. It's not coming from the inside. It's coming from the inside, not from the outside, inside.
Definitely, yeah.
And if you want to be diverted, fair enough, go on holiday, but don't tell me you're doing shamatha, because you're not. That's good, isn't it? I love it. Yes, Ali, you're welcome, Elizabeth. Ali?
Hi. I was quite interested in the quiet sign and how that would be different. Sorry, what was it called? The quiet sign. And how you would notice if that was different than the other things coming up.
Oh, you will notice. You will notice. By the time an acquired sign has come to you, your mind, you are so relaxed. Your mind is and body are so stable. Your vividness is so alert. You will easily recognize what is a disturbance and what is an acquired sign. But the acquired sign will have its own characteristics. And I went through that yesterday, the different types, but it can be different to that. But what will happen is it will start coming regularly. Regularly. And once it starts coming regularly, then you can shift your way. At that stage, you will not have any difficulty in recognizing it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anne?
I find counting a distraction, not a help. And I'm wondering whether I should be persevering with it as a useful tool or just put it aside. And I do practice regularly, and I just don't use counting.
Okay. So counting is not essential.
Okay.
It's not essential. But I will say this. I would learn how to do it, and I would learn how to do it well. As I always imagine I've got like a little doctor's case with me, and inside at various remedies that I might need at some time. That's how I think of these things. So if you learn how to do counting and learn how to do it well, there's different ways of counting. Different ways. If you learn how to do it and do it well, then put it in your bag. You may never need it again. But there may come a time, because of things that are going on in your life or your physical condition, that you find it initially quite hard to get into the zone.
Mm. See, I find it.
Open your bag and then take out the counting and use it.
Sorry.
Oh, no,
you're not. I find I can keep my focus on around here because it's what I did with Gwink for so many years. And I find I can do that quite easily. And when I start counting, I'm not thinking of this anymore.
Then don't do it.
Yeah,
if you already know how to do it,
If
you already know how, and do it well, put it in your bag of tricks. You may never need it again.
Okay, thank you.
But if something happens and you know, all live long enough, everything happens, right? You still want to meditate, you still want to do shamatha, but you're finding it difficult to just get into the zone. Then open your bag of tricks, take out the counting, use it, and then put it back in your bag.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's the best way. Thanks, Anne. Sorry, was it Tahir? Tahir, yeah?
Sorry, it's Talia. The question is also on counting. So what happened today is usually I don't count, but what happened today, and if I do count, if I lose it between 1 to 10, I'll go back to 1.
Yes, that's one way of doing it, yeah.
And today, somehow I lost it at 7, but in the background, I counted all the way to 15, and I realized I lost a 7 up to 15, and I go back to 1. So I find it quite, like, it's actually, it becomes autopilot.
Yes,
it's like you're counting. So I know Lama Allen said that we should focus not on the counting, but on the breath.
Yes.
Counting is more like a checker. Yeah. But what if that checker becomes autopilot? Like it just goes on automatically.
Then don't use it. I mean, okay. Really, I mean, we're going through all this because I want it to go into your bag of tricks. It's not essential for this practice. No, no. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes when you're beginning this practice, and not just when you're beginning, you can be doing it for years and then suddenly you go through a phase where you're finding it really difficult. What do? Do you give up because you can't do it? No, you know. Basically, I've got a mental headache. What's in my bag of tricks? Ah, counting. I forgot about that. Let me take that out and try it. And then you've got the anchor again. You've got the anchor again. And when you don't need it, you just let it go. If you find it at the moment more of a distraction because you're already well into the practice, if you know how to do it well, don't use it. Just don't use it. Yeah. I was taught many years ago the same as you. 1, 2, 3. Oh, sorry. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1. I never do that. That got me so irritated. I tell you, I just got. So basically, I don't do that. I don't know. I was taught breathing in. At the end of the in-breath, count 1. I think it's an Asanga method like that. But it really doesn't matter. There are many ways of counting breaths. So maybe just a full breath, 1. That's easy to do, no problem. And for some people still, and if you lose it, you have to start again at 1. That's how we were taught. But that just irritated me. So I just kind of did what I could. And then what happened is I got a wee bit better and a wee bit better.
Yeah, the thing is that
with all these instructions, with all of them, it is the goal that's important. The goal is important. You will alter instructions as time goes on. You will, because you're not the same as everybody else. But until you know what you're really doing, you don't alter anything. You do exactly as you're taught. But as time goes on, your psyche, your inner winds change, your ability change, and you'll start changing a little bit here and there, no problem. Even Lama Allen, I mean, if you listen to some of his How to Relax, I mean, it's actually quite different to when he first taught me. He says, I'm changing all that. I remember saying to him, you know, all these 3 breaths that you do and then you do another breath. I said, I can't be doing with that, Alan. It really, you know, can I just do it on 1? He said, I only do it on 1, but it's easier if you do it on 3. So it's like that. In the beginning, when you don't know, you follow instructions to the letter. Why else take instructions? But once you know what you're doing, you know, then what you need is guidance as opposed to like that. So do what's comfortable. If you're well into the practice, then counting can be quite tricky. It's a bit distracting. Because what happens with many people when they count, they don't just mentally go 1, 2. A lot of them, it's not staccato. It's 1, 2. Too much. Thanks very much, Jen. Anyone else? Yes, Christine.
Hello. I felt very quiet and calm after the sessions yesterday. But later, when I wanted to go to sleep, the worries and the troubling thoughts all came back with a much greater violence than usual, I felt.
Okay.
So could you comment on that?
Yes. Well, meditation does not make anything worse. It doesn't. But what meditation does do, it makes you more sensitive to what's going on in your mind. Meditation kind of, we're not aware of so much. I mean, it's almost as like we've got 1,001 veils covering our consciousness. Now, and you go for a walk and you can see, oh yes, you're seeing, and you start taking these veils off and you're seeing more and more, you know? Now, when you start shamatha, never bad for you. You can't do that. But what it does do is it kind of clears away some of these veils and you start to see more about what's going on in your own mind. And the stuff that's usually quite deep is coming more to the surface. You're not making yourself worse, you're noticing it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that teaching people how to meditate, just simply how to meditate, that's excellent. I love doing that. Anyway, teaching people how to meditate, it wouldn't be the first time someone's come up to me and said, right, I've done 4 days with you. I am now worse than I was when I started. And I say, well, what do you mean? And they say, well, you know, when I first started, I could sit down for half an hour and be really calm and really collected. 4 days of learning how to meditate with you, and I haven't got 10 breaths. So it's obviously my fault, right? Obviously. Always learn to teach you. That's no problem. And sometimes they'll listen to you. Because what's happening here, and I try to, it's what's happening is it's not that you're getting worse. You're reaching the first stage of learning to meditate. And that is recognizing how mad your mind is, how agitated your mind is, how dull. You're actually now beginning to notice. And this is wonderful. This is this. Once you, that's your first step. If you bypass that, you're never sure what's going on. So things will come up in a flourish, but it's not coming from the outside. It's never making you worse. It's your reaction to it. That's it. Now, if you're in a time when it's coming up and you just can't deal with it, and oh no, it's too much for me, then don't meditate. Meditation is for a reasonable mind, a mind that's balanced, reasonably balanced and calm and in good health. If you're going through a bad time and these things are coming up, then maybe not the right time to meditate. Go out for a walk. That's far better. Really, really. But once you're aware that really what's happening is you're settling your mind and these things are becoming clearer, then you apply the antidote. Relax and release on the out-breath. Do not cling to it. Let it go. These things have no power. However awful your thoughts are, it could be your parents dying. It could be your child being murdered. I don't care how difficult that is, how horrible. If you don't focus on it, it will disappear. It may come back, but if you don't visit, if you don't focus on it, it disappears. Now that tells you something. It has no power. So where does this power to upset us and cause us suffering from? It comes from our Velcroing ourselves to the thought. It's like Velcro. As soon as the thought comes, instead of it being a thought, it becomes my thought. So you've Velcroed it, owned it, and it's mine. And then I focus on it relentlessly. And I water it, and I add sunshine, and I allow it to grow and grow and grow and grow until... And yet, same thought coming. Let go. It comes back. Well, of course it comes back. What did you expect? We've had lifetimes of this. Keep doing it. It'll come back with less power. It'll stay with longer. And that tells us. That tells us it has no power at all unless I give it to them. So in what you could say, Christine, is that that experience you have is wonderful. On one side, I could come to you and say, I'm so happy you said that. That is fantastic. It shows that you were able to calm your mind. Other people are thinking, this girl's going to be crazy. But on the other hand, if it's disturbing you too much, then maybe time to leave it alone. Only you can decide.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Is that okay?
Yes, okay. Sure.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Anyone else? Okay, so thank you for that. So I don't know, I'm thinking, do most of you use a timer bell, a meditation bell? I highly recommend it. One of the apps. There's quite a few. They're all free. I mean, I certainly never pay for anything unless I have to. So they're all free. So the thing to do is, well, I tell you what I did one night. I downloaded about 20. That's fine. Oh, crap. No. And I whittled it down to about 4 or 5 and then practiced with them until I got one I liked. So what is good if you choose an app that has interval bells, when you're starting, an app that you don't just set it for, say, 24 minutes with a nice ding, you know, because you can get that. But you could set it so that after 10 minutes, a bell will go. Now, initially, that can be helpful, because at that stage, you might think to yourself, well, I've spent too much time here. I now want to go on to the vividness. 10 minutes later, the bell goes. Okay, time to count, you know. It can help you move, initially, it can be quite helpful. Then you get so used to it that you end up usually just using one interval bell. And that's usually, for me, it used to be 5 minutes before the end so that I could, you know, if I was getting tired, just arouse my attention and think to myself, right, it's the last 5 minutes. I'm going to be so focused here. Not tight, but so I do highly recommend that. Reminder bells can be useful, especially initially. Mm-hmm. That's only, it's far better than setting an alarm. That can be a bit tricky. So I highly recommend that. So what I'd like to talk about now is difficulties that arise. And I know at the moment we've talked about, you know, the main difficulties, and it is really the main difficulties, because everything else, every other difficulty arises from this. Agitation and dullness is like stem difficulties, right? Now, you know that stem cells in the body can then develop into any part of the body. If you've got a stem cell, you can encourage it can be encouraged to become a liver cell, a brain cell. So agitation and dullness are like the stem difficulties. Learn how to deal with that. And then you're also learning how to deal with all the other difficulties that come from agitation, that come from dullness. So the difficulties initially, when you think about it, are many, they're varied, and we encounter them all the way through in the development of shamatha. These difficulties can be physical, psychological, sociologically driven. And most of them can be overcome by direct action. And if you've studied Dharma at all, you know that a particular difficulty, you can apply a particular meditation. Have you heard that? Yes? So if you are going around and you're feeling ill will towards someone, I mean, I'm sure none of you ever feel ill will towards someone, but you know, if that ever happened, then one of the tried and tested antidotes, remedies, would be loving kindness, learning to use loving kindness. And you would do a loving kindness meditation and deal with it. If there was an idea coming into your mind a lot about contempt, that's a tricky one, because there's no way you can develop bodhicitta if really you have contempt for anyone else. To any degree of contempt, you can't do it. No. So the sovereign remedy here is to do meditations on compassion. It's quite clear. If envy or cynicism arises, then the tried and tested is to develop empathetic joy. And if craving and attachment are very strong, then within the four immeasurables, in particular, equanimity becomes. Yeah, that becomes your antidote. Now, how does this work in shamatha? The problems you come about in shamatha, once you've got, you know, your external situation is reasonable and problems are coming up this internal, they tend to be mental events. Whatever remedy you use will depend on how soon you notice what's going on. How soon you notice what's going on. If in the middle of a meditation you are totally overwhelmed with feelings of grief, of envy, of lust, of whatever, these things come up, agitation, fear. If that is strong in your mind and you can't breathe it away, then you have to apply these other techniques. That makes sense, doesn't it? But that's if you're totally overwhelmed by them. Now, let's say your mind is a wee bit more refined. Okay, and you're sitting in meditation and a thought comes. It's taking you away from the object. It's there, but it's taking you away from the object. It doesn't matter what type of thought. It could be as pleasant as you like or as awful as you like. But you're not Velcroing yourself to it, right? Then you can stop what you're doing in meditation. Watch it. Now, you're not engaging. You're not thinking, this is a nice thought, this is a bad thought, oh, poor me, how could I? Nothing like that, nothing like that. Simply observe it. Lama Allen talks about observing its nature. Literally see what's happening as it happens. Don't engage, and it will disappear quite quickly. And you go back to what you're doing. You can apply this remedy because you've not totally engaged with this thought. It's a thought has arisen that you've noticed. It's taking me away. I can't breathe it out. Okay, I'm not going to get upset about it. Let's look at its nature from a distance, no engagement. You don't give that power, it disappears. Then you just watch this. Then if you just look at the space it's disappeared into, just for a few seconds, refocus. And you can do that because you've not Velcroed yourself to it. You haven't owned it. It hasn't become yours. It's not your thought, your idea. It's just an idea with no power of its own. Now, let's say at that stage, your mind is even more relaxed. You're doing your practice, but a thought comes. If it's not taking you away from what you're doing, it's kind of just hanging about in the periphery. It's fine, let it hang about. Don't give it any energy, you're fine. But if you find yourself moving slightly towards it, you're not Velcroing it to it, you're not particularly interested in its nature, then just breathe it out. Relax more deeply. Refocus. So whatever remedy you use really does depend on how well you have owned that thought. The less ownership of that thought, the easier just to, right? The reason I'm telling you this is, it's easy for me to say, relax, release, refocus, right? But if that thought's quite strong, and it's become your thought, you can try to relax it and you just get too frustrated, you know? So remember, it's all degrees. It's got to do really with how calm your mind is. If you focus with the thought and it's overwhelming, there's not much you can do. You've tried to breathe it out, you've tried it, but it's too... Then better to leave it. Leave the shamatha. Maybe use a full meditation with an antidote to get rid of it, make your mind calm again, and then come back to the shamatha. If it's happening a lot and the breathing out's not working, but you haven't fused with it, it's just irritating slightly, then just abandon, just for a moment, stop the trying to focus on the object. You're not focusing on this, you're simply gently aware with no interest, just, oh, it's interesting. And you're looking at its nature. You're not saying how awful the thought is, how nasty, or I wish it would go away. I've only got 23 minutes left. Nothing like that. It's simply giving it no energy. And when it goes, then I find it helpful to look at where it's disappeared to. That's always in just a few seconds. And then go back. When your mind's even calmer and the thought comes, refocus. So your first port of call is always relax, release, refocus for intrusive thoughts, always. If it doesn't work, you have these other remedies. What do you think? You see, we're so binary, aren't we? If this happens, this happens. We do this. If this happens, we do this. Life is not like that. So in your bag of tricks, in this little bag I imagine that I have, there's all these little things. If I practice how to do this, then I can choose which remedy I have at that time. And sometimes it's best to stop what you're doing and go for a walk. That happens. That happens. Any questions? Any thoughts about that? No? Oh, okay. So the next thing I want to really think about is understanding what made the Buddha so special. So we know that the Buddha achieved shamatha, the first stage of shamatha, when he was a child. And when he spent all those years with the ascetics before he became enlightened, he reached the pinnacle of shamatha, which is the, I think it's the fourth dhyana. I get very confused with the dhyanas, but anyway, there's about four. And with that, you can have quite miraculous powers, they tell me. They tell me. I mean, this is one of the reasons Shantideva emphasizes shamatha so much. So much. He says, how can you help someone if you haven't got clairvoyance? So fully developing the first dhyana, one of the first powers you get is this ability to see what people need, actually need. So the Buddha had developed all that to the highest degree, and yet still, he wasn't free, and he knew it. There was no enlightenment there. And if the Buddha had died then he could have gone into the form realm or the formless realm, still within samsara, a very high level of samsara. So what was unique about the Buddha? The uniqueness about the Buddha is he realized shamatha was not the goal. The Buddha's innovation was to apply shamatha to the nature of reality. That was his innovation. No one else had done that. He used the mind that was so sharp to be clearly aware of what was happening as it happens. Complete contemplative insight. He was able to use that sharp mind to really penetrate the three marks of existence. Clearly see impermanence, clearly see suffering, clearly see non-self. He applied it to his body. In case there was anything he'd missed, he applied it to his body. Clearly realizing. He applied it to his feelings, every feeling that he had. He applied it to all his mental states. And then he applied this understanding to all phenomena around him. He could see the origination of all of this, how it presented itself, the causal efficacy of all of this, and how it dissolved. That was his innovation. Now, when I first heard that, I thought, are you telling me that I spend all this time trying to achieve shamatha, and after that, I still have to do all that? Oh, for goodness sake. I mean, how old am I? I mean, I'm already in this age, you know? How long do I think I'm going to live? So I got a wee bit sort of... So anyway, I went to see Lama Alan. I said, this is all very interesting. I kind of understand that, but you know... You saying I'm going to spend all this time and then I've got to do all that? And he just laughed. He put that same question, because we're all the same, aren't we? I mean, we're not that unique. We all have the same worries. So he put that to quite a few teachers. And the response he told me was always the same. Once you have shamatha, because the five obscurations, which is our next talk, because the five obscurations are temporarily suspended, you can move through Vipassana very quickly. Now, this wasn't one teacher. This was all the teachers, from His Holiness to Dzogchen teachers, all the way through. So I said, do I have a guarantee? And he said, come back to me when you've reached shamatha. I said, okay, I've not seen him since, right? But still. So I want you to think like that, okay? Don't be put off by various goals, thinking all of that is beyond us. What opens the door is shamatha. That really opens the door. That opens the door. And this idea that because these are five obscurations we're going to talk about next that really prevents all this. Because they're temporarily, once you achieve shamatha, these are temporarily suspended. You'll never have a mind like that. This mind is amazing. Put anything in front of this mind. And you'll be able, because you can hold it, because you've got clarity, you'll be able to penetrate it. And therefore it is said, that all the great teachers, it just doesn't take so long. It really doesn't take so long. Once you have shamatha, it doesn't take so long. Anyway, that's not me speaking. This is the text. Okay, right. I think I'd like to, I'm just looking at the time. I'd like you to look at, again, the nine stages of attentional development. And I want to refer to that now. You have the handout? Yeah? Okay. So just looking again at stage one, directed attention, learn the instructions, a few seconds, you're developing shamatha consistently. Stage two, continuous assessment, not continuous at all, but basically continuous for up for a minute, regularly. Then you have stage two, and you're thinking about this practice a lot. Your mind is still not continuously on the object. In fact, most of the time, your mind is off the object. So coarse excitation is quite strong here. Let's look at stage three here. And here's where you start to notice some, in my opinion, you start to notice progress. I think by stage two, you're noticing a difference. But from my point of view, from stage three, really, you know, this is getting better. It's called resurgent attention. So what you're looking here is your mind is being distracted, but you notice it quickly, you recover quickly, and you're mostly on the object now. So your mind more or less is on the object, but it does drift away. You notice it drifts away and you can swiftly recover it. This may happen quite a bit, but most of the time, your mind is on the object. Stage three. The problem that's persisting here, if you have the appendix, it makes it quite clear, is you still completely forget the objects for periods of time. Okay? Most of the time your mind is on the object. When the mind drifts, you kind of wake up to it and you swiftly recover and put it back on. So that's why it's called resurgent attention. You have to keep resurging, keep remembering. So although most of the time your mind is on the object, you still completely forget. There are times when you completely forget that object. And so your problem is still coarse excitation, but it's a real improvement at stage three. Anything about stage three does that seem reasonable? Can you see the progression there? Yeah, good. Now, looking at stage four, what you have at stage four is a game changer. This is a game changer here. Why? Well, by this stage, you've increased your meditation. Usually, you increase by a few minutes. You don't stick at 24 minutes, you start increasing, small amounts, 2 to 3 minutes increasing. By stage four, let's say your practice is about, and now the books vary here, but roughly speaking, let's say your practice is about an hour. Just say it's about an hour. What's achieved here? You no longer forget the object. There is not a moment from the beginning to the end of that meditation where your mind has wandered completely off the object. Now, like that tuning in I was telling you about before, you know, if you're trying to find a station. And if you've ever done this and you're not quite on the station, but you can still hear the station in the background, but there's a lot of interference, but you can still hear the station, it's like that. Although your mind never completely leaves the object, there's still a lot of interference. There's still a lot of stuff going on. And sometimes instead of the object being there, it's kind of here. Your mind has wandered here, but you're still aware of this. As long as you're still aware, even if your object isn't in the periphery and you can keep it there for the entire time, then you've achieved stage four. And now you can say that you have developed the power of mindfulness. Not saying the best mindfulness, but you now have mindfulness. That is the power. Not learning the instructions, not thinking about the practice, not trying to be mindful. The power here is mindfulness. And you can say you have a reasonable mindfulness here. Now, in stage three, you have some mindfulness because you're noticing. You have some mindfulness. Your mind is mostly on that object. But by stage four, it's very strong. It is strong now. And Lama Alan says, now, if you can achieve stage four, not just that you have one or two sessions, but this is consistent now, that you can now call yourself an experienced shamatha trainee. This stage is an experienced shamatha trainee. What's happened here is gross excitation has gone. That's gone. What is gross in your mind now is gross dullness. That's what you're going to be dealing with. You've got rid of the coarse excitation. But like I was telling you yesterday, the people cutting the grass and the hedges, they've gone, but there's still the traffic, right? So you still have medium excitation. But your biggest problem now is gross dullness, and that's what you start to deal with. Stages three and four. So mindfulness is kicking in at stage three. It's kicking in, and we'll go into mindfulness this afternoon. But mindfulness is definitely kicking in here. It's not strong, but it's there. It's active because you're keeping your mind on the object for longer and longer period of time, most of the time, in fact. By stage four, mindfulness is strong. How can you say that? Because from the beginning of your practice to the end of your session, your mind is always on the object. The object may be over here and then over here, and other things like breakfast and lunch and, oh, that guy said this or that. It's there, but you've not lost this. It's still on the peripheries. You've not lost it. Then your mindfulness is strong, very strong. At this stage, once you've achieved stage four, at this stage, put it this way. Traditional teachings in Naglupa and Shakya will say, choose your object and stay with it all the way to shamatha. Don't change it. And there's reasons for that. There is reasons, because if you start changing objects, if you're anything like me, well, the reason this is not working for me is I have the wrong object. Yeah. Just me then. Okay. So you get another object. And that goes for a while and then not working so well. So the chances are that if you change once, you'll change quite a bit. Because as we know, it's never your fault. It's always the other person's fault. It's always coming from the outside, right? And I thought that was the only way to do it. But certainly within the teachings from Padmasambhava onwards, within the Dzogchen and the Kagyu, particularly. Now, I'm not saying that if you were having problems within the Galupa or Sakya that, and you wanted to change, people wouldn't help you, but it wouldn't be emphasized. But in the Kagyu tradition and in Sakya, once you've reached stage four, then they say that you have enough mindfulness now. You have relaxation, you have stability, you have vividness, Not perfect, but it's very good. You have good mindfulness now. You can now make a decision. And Bhamasambhava said, this is the time. Because you may have persistent problems that are coming up that are now very visible to you, right? That weren't visible before, right? But now you're seeing particular problems and you're saying to yourself, staying with this one object, let's say it's the breath. You know, I don't think I can continue. I've got to this stage, but I'm not sure I can continue. At this stage, you can change. You have enough now to be able to say, I'm choosing a different object. And certainly from a lot of the Kagyu incident, they're a very good idea, you know? And if you're going to change your object, why not change it to something subtler? Subtler than an external breath. And so Lama Alan says at this stage, you could, if you wish to, change to, let's say, mind in its contents, which is the next object we're going to practice. If you're going to do it, it's a good time to do it. And in the same vein, once you get closer to the end of shamatha, end of stage 7, stage 8, it may be that you change again to pure awareness. Because all the way along that path, you're not the same person that started. Your consciousness is not as disturbed as it was. So it may be. And so in his book, he says, if you choose one object, let's say the breath, and you're happy with that, and you're working with it, and you have no problem, it's the simplest thing going, you don't even have to worry about an acquired sign that comes. Don't worry about a counterpart that comes. If you're happy, you stay with that, and that takes you all the way to shamatha with no problems, none. In the beginning, when you learn the three different objects, he will say, you may have practiced now the three, the breath, mind and its contents, and awareness. And one of them may appeal to you more than another. You may be sitting there going, watching my breath. Oh, dear Lord. I couldn't do that to stage one. So you then start practicing mind in its contents, and you suddenly think, I could do this. So you may have a preference from the beginning of mind in its contents or awareness. You may have that. And if that's the case, and you're willing to do that, then you can choose at the very beginning mind in its contents or awareness. And that will take you all the way through. You don't have to change. You don't have to. He just says that for most of us who have kind of coarse minds, very, very agitated, lots of thoughts, difficult to relax, very little. He said, for us, generally speaking, until you've achieved stage 4, he advises the breath. It's straightforward, it's simple, and it works. It works on every level. It's so useful. Even if you've got, oh, I think I'd like to do that. Yes, there's a lot of things I'd like to do. Do I have the skills? This is me speaking to me. Yeah, I know you want to do that. Do you have the skills? You can't sit down for 15 minutes. Do you not think you'd be better starting with the breath? This is the conversation I had with myself, right? So you have that conversation. But to have a meaningful conversation with yourself, practice, if you're going to stick to this type of thing, practice all three. Practice all three and say to yourself, which one is going to help me get to stage 4? That's how I think. I'll reassess it again at stage 4. Which one? And make a choice. If you have a strong inclination, and many people do, I've done at least 2 2-month retreats with Lama Alan and then others that were a week to 10 days. But I met many people, couldn't take the breath. They just said it was just too boring. I mean, I don't find the breath boring at all, but many people do. And they went straight into mind and its contents. And I met many people who were bored silly in the teachings from breath, mind and its contents. And they heard about awareness And from that moment, they were sailing on. It was just, it depends what you bring to this practice, what your propensities are. But again, one of the reasons he puts the book in this way is because for most people, straightforward, healthful object, breath. Unless you're dead, you always have breath. So, do you get that? So don't read the book and it's telling you do this, and then, okay, now. I mean, if you read the book properly, Lama Allen is very, very clear there. He makes these points time and time again. It's just sometimes people don't read that bit. They just think, oh, well, he wants you to do this, that, and then no. Practice all three. And then see. But for centuries, long time before the Buddha, during Buddha's time, all the highest, across the world, breath. That's what they say, breath. Yeah. But within the Kagyu and the Sakya, Kagyu and the Nyingma, all the Dzogchen, if you have a feeling and you could do it with mind in its contents, wonderful. It so prepares you for enlightenment. It prepares you to understand the depth of your consciousness, to recognize it. Same with awareness. Jenny?
Have you got any recommendations? If we're going on retreat, would we tend to keep to whichever one of shamatha we're doing? You know, let's say we're doing the breath, would we continue to stay with that, or on a retreat might, anyway, yes, what's your suggestion regarding retreat, personal retreat?
I'm going to answer this quickly, but towards the end I'm going to do more about retreat.
Okay,
so but just very, very quickly, it depends on your goal. Your goal for retreat should be clear in your mind. You can do a weekend retreat in your own home. And what's your goal? Your goal is to practice consistently these three.
Right.
And identify the one that you think would take you to stage four. That would be me. And once I'd identify one of these three, then I wouldn't fall into the habits that have let me down in the past, which is chopping and changing. As long as I can, as I've got a good experience of all three and being honest with myself, I would like this, and this looks more sexy than this, you know, because it is, it's very nice. What's going to get me to stage four? Then once you've got that, then whatever retreat you do, you stay on the object for sure. But we'll go on to retreat a bit more, Jenny, definitely. Thank you for that. Anyone else? No? Okay. So I think we'll end here. And this afternoon, we'll start with looking at, we've talked about mindfulness. Let's look at what mindfulness actually is. Okay, let's really look at mindfulness and be really clear. Because stage three, it's meant to be reasonable. You know, it's there, it's kicking in. So you need to recognize it, what it actually is. And by stage four, primary. So we'll talk about that. And we'll then go on to look at these five obscurations that really prevent us from delving deeply into the nature. We'll definitely attack that. And then see how we go. We may touch on mind in its contents. We'll see how that goes. Okay. Thank you so much. So before you leave, maybe just remember the motivation you had. And just keeping this morning's merit kind of safe. Just mentally direct it towards achieving what you set out to achieve. If you know the prayers off by heart, no problem. If not, just remember and focus. Thank you very much. And I hope to see you again at 2:00. Have a lovely lunch and a wee bit of a break.